We've been talking to you about the Latino vote in our series A Votar for the last few weeks, and today we turn to the Cuban vote.
These folks truly believe that a vote for Biden is a vote for socialism in the U.S., even though Biden is not a socialist, and you know we know that, and he has said it many times.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Tuesday, October 20th, why so many Cuban American voters are supporting President Trump this election. And the pandemic has disrupted every aspect of our lives, including time. So how do we break the time warp? But our lead story today, the former chair of the Republican Party endorses Joe Biden. We're talking with Michael Steele. Earlier this year, a group of top GOP strategists, media specialists, and lawyers surprised many when they formed a new political action committee called the Lincoln Project. In a New York Times op-ed, the group said their goals were to highlight the American values that President Trump has trampled on and to persuade enough, quote, disaffected conservatives, Republicans, and Republican-leaning independents to vote President Trump out of office. The group's political ads have been successful at grabbing the media and President Trump's attention so far. They've even subverted older Republican ads to convey their new message, like this take on Ronald Reagan's famous It's Morning in America ad.
There's mourning in Ohio. Today, hundreds of thousands of Americans have died from a deadly virus Donald Trump ignored.
The Lincoln Project has also created ads targeting the president's race-baiting comments, his refusal to disavow white supremacy, and his attacks against Black Lives Matter. Trump Republicans made a concerted effort to repudiate the issues that the Lincoln Project have targeted and have now taken to calling them rhinos or Republican in name only. One of the most high-profile members of the Lincoln Project is Michael Steele, the former chair of the Republican National Committee from 2009 to 2011, and the only Black person to have served in that position. He's now senior advisor at the Lincoln Project, and he just endorsed Democrat Joe Biden for president. Michael Steele, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Tanzina, it's great to be with you. Absolutely.
So much to talk about.
I know, right? I thought I'd bring a little news with me.
Just a little, and we'll take all of it. You just announced that you're endorsing Joe Biden and Kamala Harris for the White House. You cannot get any more anti-Trump than that, Michael.
Well, you know, it's not anti-Trump. I want to be very clear about this.
Okay.
I could give a rat's patootie about Trump. This is about the country for me. This was not an easy decision. It didn't wake up and go, oh, yeah, that's what I'll do today. This was long in the making, and it was made by Trump. This moment was created by Trump. His abject failure to deal with COVID-19, his irresponsibility when it comes to managing the economy, the lack of consideration of others. I mean, just showing empathy, being aware, the way he speaks about our veterans. All of these things for me matter. And it's just, you know, I'll tell you, Tanzina, it's one of those things that I was struck on two fronts. The first was I recalled when I ran for the U.S. Senate, five Democrats in this county where I live, Prince George's County, Maryland, endorsed me for the United States Senate against their party interest, against their political interest, and certainly against their policy interests for some who were very strong supporters of choice, and I happened to be pro-life. And yet what they said stood out to me, and I recalled it, and they were like, look, it's not about the policy or the politics. It's about the leadership we need right now. And I thought about that, and I said, this is a moment for me to pay it forward. They trusted me, those five Democrats, in their endorsement of me, a Republican, in a Democratic state. Said a lot. And so here we are today. I'm trying to say a lot to my country is like, we're better than what we've seen and experienced over the last 3 years. And I hope it resonates for a lot of voters. So it's not about Trump. This is really about the country. Because when you add it all up, when you're looking at the election of a president, we're looking at someone who represents us. And that
but he
matters.
He also, Michael, represents the Republican Party, and at least in this election and
so
in the 2016
I.
election. So I want to ask you that because he is. Let's start here. What do you say are the core values of Republican conservatism today? And how have they changed under this president?
Oh, well, there are none. I mean, that's the point. The party turned its back on a platform. It couldn't even tell the country in this political cycle what it stood for. It essentially said, well, we'll wait till Donald Trump tells us what we believe. And, you know, we'll regurgitate what we said 4 years ago and we'll just go with that. Well, that's fundamentally irresponsible. This moment today is vastly different from where the country was in 2016. I mean, we are being ravaged by COVID-19 yet again, unabated. We are still reeling economically. 13, 14 million Americans still have not recovered their jobs. Another million last week posted for unemployment. You've got the civil unrest that the country is coming to grips with in the era of Black Lives Matter. The 180 on that alone, given everything else, would be enough to say how different this time is. And yet we're stuck in a warp where, you know, the president's still tweeting about, you know, Hillary Clinton and going after, you know, the ghost of Robert Mueller and Burisma. And so the reality is, you know, the country's moving on and our leader is stuck in another place in time. And my party cannot find it within itself to even state what it is we believe and what it is we stand for. So it does matter in terms of understanding, for me at least, as one someone who led the party that talked about those underlying principles of freedom and opportunity and tying it to various policies from healthcare to the environment, that we have a voice in this, but we've given that voice over to Trump.
But how do you explain that, Michael? Because the party could have disavowed more broadly the president for all of the reasons that you're saying, because in many ways he's an aberration to what the party has said it stood for. And I want to talk a little bit about that, because a lot of the issues with the Republican Party didn't start with President Trump. But how do you explain the fact that the Republican Party writ large have really fallen in line behind this president and have sort of abdicated in many ways for some Americans their responsibility, their moral responsibility?
I have grappled with that question. I've gotten into very deep and heated arguments with colleagues and friends inside the party who give me their justification. And on the surface of it, it's, oh, well, you know, he promised tax cuts and he delivered. He promised the Supreme Court and he delivered, you know, and I'm like, well, is that really it? So all the things about the institutions that we have grounded ourselves in terms of upholding this republic and shoring up this democracy that he spits on every day, you're okay with that. You're okay with having an attorney general who, you know, is of a mind to agree with the president that we should just lock up his political enemies. I mean, when did you turn that corner? When did you embrace Vladimir Putin and the Russians?
And what do they say, Michael? I mean, what is it all about? Because tax cuts in the Supreme Court? I mean, is there some sort of justification for this? Because there are other elements to this Trump presidency that some would argue have also encouraged members of the GOP to sign on for.
No, I that's it. I mean, I have not gotten that. My point is, I have not gotten an answer that speaks to the core of what we used to articulate as Republicanism or conservatism. It is. You got to stand with the president. I'm like, no, I don't. I said, you. I told one friend. I said, you were the same fool out there screaming at President Bush over the Iraq War. You broke from President Bush over the Iraq War. You broke away from President Bush on the deficit spending that occurred at that time to support the war. And yet you said nothing about $1 trillion deficit on the books for this year alone and another $6 trillion in debt. You've said absolutely nothing about that. So it's helped me understand what it is. And part of it is this fear of getting tweeted at or having the base turn on them. But I'm like, dude, the base is getting smaller and smaller. We've not expanded our reach into this country. Tell me the conversation we're having with the lesbian gay community. Tell me the conversation we're having with black folks beyond saying, oh, yeah, black unemployment is the lowest ever been.
Let's talk about that conversation, Michael, because that conversation is happening. It's happening. We are at, you mentioned this earlier, we are at a reckoning, one of many that we've had in this country over the course of many decades. But this summer in particular was an uprising for racial justice. We have seen, you know, people, black Americans killed at the hands of police officers in this country. And yet this racial tensions, to say very lightly here, are something that the president has stoked and has, you know, in many ways failed to denounce white supremacy, although, you know, he might go back and forth on that. So that conversation is one that's really, you know, driving, I think, a lot of the concern here. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you have to be polite because you're NPR, and I appreciate that. I will put it bluntly. It's not stoking it. It is deliberately exacerbating it. It is deliberately inflaming those passions. And then to plead ignorance, you don't know who, you know, Proud Boys are. Of course you do, because the White House is briefed on them. They know exactly what's going on. This is the same man who told us he had no idea who David Duke was. Seriously, you're a 70-something-year-old white man and you don't know who David Duke is? So the reality of it is, we've got to be honest about what's in front of us. The president took a very important moment 6 years ago, 5 years ago, with Colin Kaepernick when he made a public statement, turned it into something ugly politically. And now the country's come 180 degrees around to that, recognizing what that moment, that Black Lives moment, was all about. Similarly, the same thing, we've seen it play out time and time again in other areas of our culture, our life, and our politics with this president. So I think the more we are honest about what we're seeing and hearing from him, the closer we are to understanding why, as I've stated, this country matters more to me than Donald Trump. And it is worth it to me to support someone who I think, even though I will disagree with him on policy all day long, and will fight tooth and nail over those policies, that I believe is a decent, good man who at the end of the day is willing to step into that breach and try to find healing around race, try to find healing around COVID-19, try to find healing around our economy. And look, I'm not saying that, you know, Joe Biden is the be-all and the end-all. He's a flawed person like everyone else, but at least I know he's willing to take a moment, look me in the eye, and say, look, hey, let's do this walk together. Donald Trump is looking to blame someone for the walk that we're taking right now.
Michael, the founders of the Lincoln Project, which you're a part of, are trying to reclaim this GOP narrative away from President Trump and to bring the party back to its core principles. But a lot of the issues in the GOP, Michael, did not start with President Trump. Some political analysts argue that this really goes back decades. The sort of political infighting, the inability for folks on either side of the aisle to work together. So how do you explain that right now?
Oh, I think that's very true analysis. I saw it emerge during my time at the RNC with the growth of the Tea Party, which was a very different group of activism and activists at that time between that 2009-2012 versus what it morphed into after 2012. It became the Freedom Caucus, and then subsequently what we see now is Trumpism. But that analysis is correct. It does go back. It actually goes back to the 1980s when Newt Gingrich came to Congress and sort of brought a sort of insurgent kind of view of how to operate inside the House and tactically went after Democrats after 40 years of one-party control of the House by Democrats from 1954 to 1994. So that insurgent spirit was there. The problem with it was there was no management of it. There was no what's the goal here? Now that you have the House, and we saw this immediately crumble under Newt, by 1996 he was out. You know, the leadership structure had begun to fall around him. So the reality of it is those frustrations grew. A lot of the base had checked out. They thought that the party was not honest and had become corrupt around principle. And so you see this now playing out. Trump comes in and is sort of picked at that old scab in many ways, and has drawn a lot of voters back to the party that has stepped aside for whatever reason. But now around him, not around an idea, not around a goal or policy or principle, but around this sort of cult of personality. I've watched people and listened to them when they are asked, so what do you like that Donald Trump has done for you? And they can't really put their finger on something. And then I watched this one woman, she said, well, he just makes me feel good. And if that's where we are in our politics, then it speaks a lot about the moment we're in on both parties, who've let down the American people in many ways that have led to this frustration. But, you know, Tanzina, just to be honest, it's not just on the Republican side. The same battles are occurring on the left as well.
We're definitely seeing these policy and directional battles with both parties sort of playing out. I 100% agree. I think there's been lots of criticism of the left and of Democrats in particular for their inability the fact that they may take black and brown voters for granted, for example.
Absolutely. And you're seeing that reflected in the fall off to some degree. If you look at 16 compared to now, with Joe Biden among African-American men, especially not so much with women at this point, but certainly with men. So there are a lot of different dynamics at place here. A lot of this goes to the core of how Americans look at themselves and view the country right now. And when you don't see yourself as part of that narrative anymore, sort of hot populism becomes popular. And it at least it's something to gravitate to. It's a wave you can ride. But at the end of the day, you still have a country to run and you still have services to provide. The needs of the people still have to be met. And
well,
it's going to require leadership to do that.
Let me just interrupt you there, because you're not the only high-profile Republican that has spoken out against the president. So I want to ask you, Ben Sasse, Nebraska Senator Ben Sasse, recently told his constituents that he's never been on the Trump train, that he's worried that if President Trump loses, he could take the Senate down with him. Two questions for you, Michael, as we close this out. First of all, are you prepared, or is there going to be a Republican bloodbath, number one? Number two, is this party worth fighting for, or has President Trump forever damaged the GOP?
So that's both very good questions. The bloodbath had started. It was interrupted. It will realign itself and reemerge regardless of whether Trump wins or doesn't, because then the battle, if he wins, becomes over who carries the mantle of Trumpism. And then there are those of us inside the party who will be like, hell no, we're not staying on this road. If he loses, that battle will obviously engage, because then it's the setup for 2024. In either case, a setup for 2024. And again, it's not just about Trumpism, but it's about the core of what Republicanism and conservatism are, which are, you know, one entity sits within the other. The Republican Party is the broader philosophical approach to all things, if you will, and conservatism is an aspect of that. And so to your second
point. So is there the potential, Michael, there for an emergent different thought process, different party, different alignment if this GOP, as it stands, does not reflect the rest of the values?
Yes, exactly. And so I think that's going to be the ongoing battle as this thing plays itself out, is how do we reshape the party and hold on to those values that we were founded on. I call them Lincoln values. That's why I call myself a Lincoln Republican. So that will be the fight over what it means to be a Lincoln Republican versus being a Trump Republican.
There have been some reports that show that the president has sort of spoken down about his support from the evangelical community, that he actually mocks them behind their back. How important is this community to the GOP overall? And what is that? What kind of damage could the president be doing or not doing with the evangelical vote?
It's very important, and it's been a part of the GOP base since 1980. For the first time in 1980, the party had reached out to the then emerging evangelical community as a political force, and we knew them then as the moral majority. And the party took the steps to put a pro-life plank in its political platform for the first time, taking a stance on the social issues. So there's been a long history between the evangelical community and the GOP. Trump, who has very little regard for any of that because he's not a religious man, he's not someone who sees the value from that stance, from that standpoint, sees it more as a transactional relationship. So as has been recorded and reported, in those moments, he speaks how he really feels. And it has created a strain within the community as a whole. For a lot of us looking at it, I'm not an evangelical. I'm a Catholic Christian. And I scratch my head at the community, largely speaking, because of the positions it's taken in public and how it has use those views and those positions to chastise and reprimand Americans for their behavior, et cetera. And yet when it came to Trump, they just kind of went, well, that's okay. We get a Supreme Court justice out of this who will overturn Roe versus Wade. And I think now some of that's coming back up on them in a very powerful way. There is a clear split in the evangelical community between white evangelicals, for example, and black evangelicals, who are less inclined towards Trumpism, a lot less inclined towards Trumpism. So those tensions are now playing itself out. And what it means for the base, particularly with Mike Pence being on the ticket, is he is hoped to be the glue to kind of hold those white evangelicals in place, despite the reported utterances of the president that is spoken very crudely about evangelicals.
Michael, you mentioned being a Catholic, a Christian and a Catholic, and you mentioned the Supreme Court. So I'd have to ask about what your thoughts are on the Republican Supreme Court strategy, which is one of the hallmarks of the Trump administration, something that he has made good on for his supporters in many ways.
Right.
This would be, in fact, the third justice under the Trump administration should Amy Coney Barrett seated on the court. And so I'm wondering what your thoughts are on the tactics that the party has taken to confirm her, in this moment with just 2 weeks before the presidential
right.
election.
I like the justice. I've read and followed some of her jurisprudence. I don't have a lot of problems with that. I think, just as a quick sidebar on that, I don't think she's going to turn out to be this very scary conservative on the court. I think, in fact, given her tutelage under Justice Scalia and other jurisprudence, I think she's going to align herself a lot more with Justice Roberts than people may come to realize. But we'll see how that plays out. Where I have the problem, Tanzina, is with the process and the sheer in your face, do as I say, not as I do kind of attitude that the Republicans had brought to this process. Now, we know where it all began. It just all goes back to the Bork nomination when then Senator Ted Kennedy really twisted Republicans' nose out of joint over the Bork nomination. And that battle has been playing itself out for over 30 years. But it's unfortunate in this moment that we will use the judiciary process and the Supreme Court nomination process to slapdash a nomination and put in jeopardy the credibility of a good judge. And it's unfortunate. It's the politics. Everyone decries the politics, but they're very quick to play it, particularly in this space, which is unfortunate. Now the concern is out there about, the Democrats coming on the back end and court packing. And of course, to do that, they'd have to remove the filibuster provisions, rules in the Senate, both of which I think are dangerous moves. and ill-advised on so many levels, because once you get rid of the filibuster, the Senate then becomes no better than the House. And to be in the minority in the Senate would be no different than being in the minority in the House. You have no power, you have no say, and that's not how our founders designed our system. There's a reason for checks and balances. There's a reason for having the Senate be the deliberative body, if you will, and it's important that that be retained. But the politics of the moment are dictating outcomes, and that can be a very dangerous thing.
Last question for you, Michael. One of the things that we've seen during under this administration has been, as you said, you know, very early on, the not just the fanning of the flames, but almost a complicit nature of the president sort of winking at white supremacist groups. We are seeing the FBI and the CIA have both said that this domestic terror is one of the most dangerous things that this country is facing right now, particularly among young white males who are armed. The Republican Party has historically had strong support for the Second Amendment, but these groups tend to take that to another level. Michael, what do you see, whether President Trump is elected or not elected? This seems to have opened Pandora's box in terms of dangerous racial tensions in this country. I don't know if we're going to be able to go back after this.
No, I completely agree with you on that and your analysis of it. We are in a very important and dangerous time. So let's start with the truth of what we must do as a nation, and what our Department of Justice and FBI and other services in the criminal justice space must do, and that is call the thing what it is. Let's define these groups for what they are. They're domestic terrorist organizations. They engage in behavior that undermine the rule of law of this country, since some of my side like to throw around that term. Well, let's throw it around and plaster it all over these groups and these organizations that are hiding behind the American flag, that wrap themselves in a false ideology about this country, and call the thing what it is. Once you do that, then you can prosecute it. You can then go about the business of checking its influence and checking its reach, particularly to younger members of our community. We have to safeguard against that as a nation. We cannot give it license. And we certainly can't allow, nor should we allow, the leader of our country to feign ignorance at best and complicitness at its worst. So I'm all about putting a bright Klieg light on it and using all the powers of both the government as well as civic activism to root out this level of hate, because that more than anything else will undermine the true words of our founding documents when it comes to the freedom and equality of every people and every person.
And just before we let you go, Latino voters in the GOP, are you excited about which way those folks could vote this year?
Yeah, every vote is a vote you need. And so the party, across the board on both sides have to fight for that vote. And I think Joe Biden can make the case, and I hope he does, and I'll help him do it.
We'll see what happens there. Michael Steele, former head of the RNC and a senior advisor at the Lincoln Project. Michael, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.
All this month, we're taking a look at the issues that matter most to Latino voters in the 2020 election. Today, we're looking at Cuban-American voters, and we're hearing from our listeners on this exact topic. Here's what you had to say.
This is Sarah Hu, calling from Lakewood Ranch, Florida. I am a Cuban-American, second generation, and what I am most concerned with in this election is the protection of human rights and human dignity and equal treatment for all. I mean, these are, you know, really founding principles that are just being trampled on today. Whether you look at, you know, the reaction to peaceful protests, or whether you look at, you know, immigration law, or whether you look at the rhetoric coming out of the White House, it's just atrocious. So, you know, as a person of color, as the daughter of an immigrant, these are the things that are most concerning to me. If we don't have this, what do we have as a country?
Hello, my name is Julio. I live in San Francisco. I think I'm just concerned about a huge number of Latinos that they're not getting clear information. They're just getting one-side information, and that can become more likely for people to vote for one president that, rather than another one. I think there needs to be more information for Latinos from all perspectives so they can have a more clear understanding and a better way to make a decision.
If you're listening and you want to share your thoughts with us about how you're voting, give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Llámenos al 877-869-8253. In 2016, Donald Trump won the state of Florida by roughly 110,000 votes. And while the majority of Latinos in Florida did not vote for the president, roughly 54% of Cuban-American voters did back Trump, contributing to his narrow victory. And this year, there are signs that support for the president among Cuban-Americans in Florida has in fact grown. A recent poll from Florida International University of Cuban-Americans in South Florida found that 59% plan to vote for Trump this election. Part of that enthusiasm stems from the Trump campaign's extensive efforts to court Cuban-American voters, which date back to the beginning of Donald Trump's time in office. The president's relentless attacks on Joe Biden and the Democratic Party as socialist also appear to be resonating with some Cuban Americans. Joining me now is Michael Bustamante, an assistant professor of history at Florida International University. Michael, thanks for being with me.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Also with us is Carmen Cecin, a reporter with NBCNews.com and NBC Latino. Carmen, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tanzina.
Carmen, let's start with you. We talked a little bit about the president's strategy in courting Cuban Americans. Why else are we seeing increased enthusiasm?
I think it all started with the sanctions on Cuba early on in the Trump administration. Even though during the Obama years, it seemed that a lot of Cubans were on board with this, this kind of struck a chord with them. And they started seeing him differently. And I spoke to Cuban voters back then about how they felt. And many of them said, I know that these sanctions hurt my relatives in Cuba, but at the same time, I kind of like it when the U.S. government is tough on the Cuban government. So I think it started with that. And as you said, the courting, I mean, it wasn't just the campaign events, but each time that the administration had a major policy speech, they would come to Miami and do it. And that really had the same effect as a campaign rally. I mean, they were speaking to an audience full of Cuban Americans, and that would energize them.
Michael, how have Donald Trump's and Joe Biden's messages to Cuban American voters differed this year?
I think the contrast is almost more about the intensity of the messaging in a way. Quite frankly, until recently, the Biden campaign's efforts to reach out to Cuban American voters, I think, have been striking for their not absence entirely, but they certainly had kind of a light footprint, right? And as Carmen was just saying, the Trump team has been in Miami steadily leading up to the 2016 election and ever since. I don't know of a major metropolitan area that has received more high-level visits from the Trump administration. So the Trump administration's rhetoric on Cuba is certainly part of it. And I think Biden has kind of been a little bit reticent to kind of get into those waters. You've seen them do more on that front lately. But I have to say, I think in so many ways, the tough talk on Cuba is almost not about Cuba. It's in some ways a proxy for broader ideological debates that we're having in this country and is really a proxy for concerns in our domestic politics.
Also, can you put in perspective for us, Michael, what the Cuban American vote means nationally for the quote unquote Latino vote versus what it means in Florida?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, I think sometimes we speak about the Cuban vote as equal to Florida, right? Certainly it matters in Florida. I would say that even in Florida, it's less important as a percentage of the total Latino vote in Florida than it used to be, surely by virtue of the growth of other non-Cuban Latino populations in the state. I think Puerto Ricans, for example. But, you know, Florida's a margins game and it's a swing state. So the Cuban vote still matters. But I think if you get outside of Florida, there's a significant kind of Cuban population in the tri-state area, New York City, northern New Jersey. There are smaller pockets of Cubans in places like Houston, Texas, Austin, Texas, Louisville, Kentucky. And frankly, we have much less information about how those communities tend to vote. If I had to guess, I think the community in South Florida trends more Republican, trends more right-leaning than the Cuban diaspora as a whole nationwide. But of course, the Cuban diaspora is heavily, heavily concentrated in South Florida. So, you know, that difference matters.
Carmen, when you talk to Cuban American voters, what are they telling you about the two presidential candidates?
So there are different groups. You have the historic exile, which is those Cubans who mostly came in the 1960s, 1970s, who are older now. Many of them have actually passed away already. You also have Cuban Americans that were born and raised here in the U.S., or at least raised here. Those lean a little bit more Democratic. And then you have more recent arrivals, those who came after 1980, and especially those who came from 1995 on. That's where you see a shift in support for Trump. And the FIU poll that you mentioned at the beginning cites that those who came from 2005 up until recently, I believe something like 76% support Trump, which is an amazing number. So when you talk to these people, the historic exiles, like always, lean Republican for the same issues. But where you see that shift and where you see the most fervent support for Trump is among those more recent arrivals. And when you talk to them, the messaging in the past several months has completely turned to socialism in the United States. So these folks truly believe that a vote for Biden is a vote for socialism in the U.S., even though Biden is not a socialist. And, you know, we know that and he has said it many times. But they think that Kamala Harris is more liberal. They're afraid of the influence that Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders or New York Rep. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez could have on a Biden administration. And so when you talk to them, it's all referencing what they went through in Cuba. They feel that they really lived through communism, unlike other Cuban Americans. Those that came recently, they feel that they really know what communism is. And so they tell me, you have no idea what it's like to stand on a line for hours under the sun to go shopping for food. And then when you get to the store, there's nothing left and you have to go home empty handed and you don't have food or milk for your children. You know, you don't know what it's like to get on a bike and have to bike for hours under the sun to get to work because, you know, there was no gas to drive a car. So they're constantly referencing those things. And they believe that if Biden wins, we're just so much closer to socialism in the United States. Cuban style of socialism.
Michael, what about the gender differences that you're seeing? Are there differences in how men and women Cuban American voters feel about the candidates?
My impression based on the FIU polling that was done is that some of the gender differences that you see in the national electorate are reflected in the Cuban American electorate. But I'd like to just go back quickly to the socialism point because I think this is so key and so kind of at the core of what's happening in the Cuban American community. You know, it's been highly distressing because, you know, not in Bernie Sanders' wildest dreams has anything that he's proposed equal dictatorship of the proletariat or total state control of all aspects of the private economy. And yet that's kind of the way in which this label socialism is being invoked. And to Carmen's point about kind of the personal stories and traumas that Cubans bring to that conversation, and particularly, you know, recently arrived Cubans, there's some unmistakable irony here, right? Those are the very lines that those folks remember as such a kind of a searing experience. Those have been aggravated in recent years because of the pile-on effect sanctions of the Trump administration on Cuba. More recent Cuban arrivals left the island at a time when, relative to, say, 20 years ago, there was somewhat of an opening toward private enterprise. compromise that seemed to, for a moment, kind of lift expectations. So it's a very perplexing thing. This shift in support for Trump among the recently arrived migrants, it's definitely kind of one of the main storylines here. It's unclear how much of a political impact it's going to have to me because, you know, the more recently arrived you are, perhaps the less likely you are to have become a citizen yet. But we're trying to disentangle sort of what's driving that. And it's not just the disinformation. It's you know, folks who have a lack of understanding about the deep history of some of the issues that are at the forefront of U.S. domestic politics. So in addition to this kind of Biden equals socialism sort of thing, there's all kinds of misinformation and, frankly, racist talk that circulates on these WhatsApp groups about Black Lives Matter sort of being the sort of sleeper cell of the Democratic Party. And it's pretty awful if I have to, you know, there's no other way that I can put it.
Now, if you could give us a little bit more info on what the messages that are being spread about Black Lives Matter in particular, where are they coming from and what are they meant to trigger among certain Cuban American voters and conservative voters?
Sure. I mean, I think a little bit of background may be helpful quickly. You know, I think one of the things that's so interesting but also vexing about sort of South Florida and Miami is that, you know, the image of this place outside of South Florida is that it's a melting pot, people from all over the place, especially from Latin America and the Caribbean, right? And that kind of multiculturalism is celebrated. It's something that city boosters celebrate. And yet that image exists on top of a deep embedded history of racial tensions, inter-ethnic tensions, right? Miami was, back in the day, a Jim Crow city before Cubans really transformed the ethnic makeup of the city in the 1960s. So add on to that the fact that in Latin America, you know, Latin American society share so much in common with the United States in terms of a history of race relations, and also the history of certain members of those societies to deny that there is a complex history of race relations or to deny that racism is a problem. So how that manifests today is you have real sort of polarization between immigrant communities, Latino immigrant communities, who are generally whiter relative to sort of the racial composition of the societies from where they come, kind of looking around them and saying, well, you know, if I was able to sort of build, you know, achieve a certain kind of success here as a migrant, you know, what are these other people complaining about? It's kind of a classic iteration of that conversation, right? Slavery happened so long ago, let's not talk about it. And so Black Lives Matter is really getting invoked as part of this slippery slope to socialism. There has been much made of the ties between certain members of the Black Lives Matter movement and the governments in, say, Venezuela, but there really has been a kind of selectivity to that narrative. We're not talking about the majority here. There's been a lot made of sort of the looting, right? Way over what it was in terms of a reflection of the broader protest movements. So there is a sort of a racial animus here at play, and kind of seeing, you know, you get this kind of inheritance of Latin American racial politics brought here, you know, meeting with the U.S. domestic rhetoric of law and order, and that's the recipe out of which so much of this misinformation is coming.
Carmen, when you hear that and when you, I mean, what does your reporting tell you about that element here, the racial element that's getting played out and the messaging that a lot of Cuban Americans, and I would even argue that certain Venezuelan Americans in Florida might be sort of leaning towards?
So there's definitely a demographic difference. So I'd say those who are raised here in this country kind of understand the Black Lives Matter movement and perhaps even participated in the protests and everything. Where you see the difference is among those who grew up not only in Cuba, but in all over Latin America. That I heard continuously during the protests. I remember hearing from two Latinas when the protests erupted again, their comments were, oh my God, how do they allow this in this country? And they weren't Cuban American. And same thing, I recently wrote a story on Colombian American voters in Florida, and I interviewed a Republican Colombian, and I asked him why he thinks there's a shift. There are more Colombians supporting Trump this year in Florida than in 2016. So I asked him why, and the first topic he mentioned was the Black Lives Matter movement. So there's exactly what Michael Bustamante mentioned. It's the whole race relations in Latin America reflected here in the United States. And yes, there's a lot of disinformation, and they're definitely equating the Black Lives Matter movement to Marxism. I'm not sure who started that or where it started. I have spent an enormous amount of time watching YouTube channels from Colombia that do spread disinformation, misinformation, conspiracy theories, And that's a constant theme there. They constantly mention the Black Lives Matter movement and how this equates to communism and Marxism, that this is their way of getting into the United States and spreading communism. And these videos, they're watched here in the United States. They're hour-long shows. They get clipped to like maybe 1 minute or 30 seconds, and then they're spread through WhatsApp or they're posted on Facebook, and everyone watches it here. And some of those programs get over 1 million views. So people are watching them.
So the ugly racial politics that are playing out abroad are also seemingly playing out here as we head into this election. Lots to continue to talk about and think about. Carmen Cecin is a reporter with NBCNews.com and NBC Latino, and Michael Bustamante is an assistant professor of history at Florida International University. Thanks so much to you both for joining me.
Thanks.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
You can hear all of the segments from our series A Votar online at thetakeaway.org/Latino voters.
Good morning.
Morning.
Oh, and in case I don't see you, good afternoon, good evening, and good night.
The coronavirus pandemic has disrupted almost every aspect of our lives, and that includes our sense of time. Depending on the month, week, day, even hour, time seems to either drag on forever or is gone in the blink of an eye. And that was especially true early on in the pandemic, when communities across the country and the world were on lockdown. During that time, and even now, months later, I still see jokes on Twitter saying things like, quote, "What a year this week has been," or reminders stating the obvious that it is in fact Tuesday, for example. For some, days of the week have ceased to exist altogether, though clocks and calendars continue to tick on as usual. Instead of Sunday, Monday, and so on, there's just Blur's Day. Stephen Johnson has been thinking a lot about our newly distorted perceptions of time. He's an audience editor at The Washington Post and recently started a newsletter about time during the pandemic called What Day Is It? Stephen, great to have you with me.
Hi, Tanzina. Thanks for having me.
Just to double check, it's Tuesday, right?
Yeah, it is.
Okay. Stephen, why has our sense of time become so distorted during this pandemic?
A lot of our routines were thrown into question. Everything was up in the air. We didn't have a solid sense of the future. And it's especially that sense of the future that's continued now. Normally, we have what we call like anchor points that ground us in time, you know, the mix of routines and new events that can help us distinguish Tuesday from Wednesday from Thursday. And those can be anything like going out after work to meet up with friends or seeing other friends on the weekends. They have a lot to do with social relationships and the things that keep you grounded in your community, and your relationships are also what keep you grounded in time. And the pandemic took a lot of those things away from us. It's obviously a time of distance and isolation for a lot of people. They're stuck at home. They don't have much to differentiate one day from another. So I wanted to talk with psychologists and see what factors might help us do that.
We've been talking a lot about the mental health aspects of the coronavirus pandemic and how a lot of folks are faring. And this has been a largely traumatic event for a lot of people. What is the relationship between time and trauma?
The field of time perception is pretty old, but more recently, there's been a look at the connection between time perception and trauma. One researcher I spoke with at UC Irvine finds that there is this kind of what she calls temporal disintegration. A large trauma like this breaks your connection with the past, present, and future, and it really grounds you right into the present moment. It does a special damage to your sense of the future and makes your window of planning much, much sooner. You have to think only a day or two ahead instead of several months at a time, and all of your plans are kind of thrown into question. So the challenge is to regain a sense of the future and be able to pass through the present in a kind of fulfilling way instead of being glued to every second as it passes by through either dread or stress or worry.
I'm wondering if the perception of time and the passage of time is different depending on each of our home scenarios.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think having kids at home is a huge factor that will change how much control, how much a sense of control you feel you have over your time, just because there are other people in your life who you have to take care of who have their own demands on your time or have their own needs. There was a study in the UK that was able to kind of break down how time passed more quickly for some people during lockdown and slower for other people during lockdown. It found about an even split between younger, busier people who felt time pass actually more quickly in lockdown and older, maybe more bored people or isolated people who felt time pass much more slowly.
Also thinking about time markers, when we think about the holidays that are coming up, we think about the new year. I, for example, I have a birthday today, and I'm looking at this and saying, well, normally I just look at those occasions, at birthdays in particular, as sort of like, you know, markers that don't really matter as much as the end of the year. But this time I'm saying, well, you have to internally, you know, adjust our milestone clock.
Well, happy birthday.
Thank you. But it doesn't feel like any, it feels more like the new year than it does. You see what I'm saying? Like this whole concept of time is so bizarre.
Oh, totally. Yeah. I mean, I'm thinking about my birthday coming up soon. I was too lazy to even get something together to celebrate my last birthday before the pandemic happened. And now I feel like that was a huge missed opportunity. I think part of the challenge and one thing psychologists told me was that we just really have to shrink our frame of reference and think small. One thing that people really turned to right at the beginning of the pandemic was these large group Zooms, either Zoom happy hours or Zoom celebrations. And a lot of people really quickly found that was exhausting. One psychologist told me there's a reason for that. It's even extroverts would find those huge group Zooms exhausting and found it much more fulfilling to engage with people just one-on-one individually, whether it's virtually or in person. And those kinds of meaningful relationships can carry you much further than the big group interactions can. And I think that's kind of what we have to depend on right now.
You mentioned a concept called anchor points. What are those?
The commute is a good example. Every single day, you know that you're going to go to work and come back to work. Now, either because people are working remotely or because they're unemployed, they don't have that. So you think about them on the daily level and also on the weekly level. You know that maybe on Fridays, you would see some friends after work. That doesn't happen anymore. Part of what we can do now is actually lay out our week, what our daily and weekly routines look like. And what I pretty quickly found was that I really had almost none a few months into lockdown. I had some kind of routine, but it was unconscious and it still felt kind of haphazard. And what I actually found kind of paradoxically was like every tip or practice that psychologists gave me had to do with building some kind of structure back in. That kind of rankled me at first. It didn't feel right. But I found out that as soon as I started doing that, it actually reduced a lot of stress and uncertainty for me and gave me something to look forward to. So a couple examples, I set aside Wednesday evenings to literally do nothing. And that doesn't stop me from taking breaks at other times. But basically after I log off, I might just light a candle, put my phone in another room and literally just stare at a wall. And maybe that gets some weird looks from my roommates. But over time, I pretty quickly started looking forward to it. And I knew that Wednesday was my day to completely disengage. Similarly, I also set aside Thursdays for some kind of volunteering or service. Psychologists know that connections with your community are a huge factor in promoting resilience, in helping people stay through this thing and feel a sense of purpose, because that's one of the biggest things that we've lost is a sense of purpose around just the daily and weekly activities that we have.
It's interesting that you say that. I try to wake up an hour before my son wakes up just to have a cup of coffee and in peace, you know, to have that moment, even if it's at 5 a.m. Stephen, this has arguably changed, the pandemic has arguably changed how we live in so many ways. And I'm wondering if, as we head into the winter and the colder months here, at least in the Northeast, and the pandemic, really, we have no idea when it's going to end. Do you think we're going to savor time more? And what I mean is by taking away our commutes, you know, some of that was stressful. Some of that was just, you know, we're running on you know, this rat race, right? And we're on this treadmill and every day we wake up and we get to our jobs and we do them and we come home. And while some of that might have been fulfilling and helped us create days and structure, some of that was also very stressful. Are we in a moment now where we're starting to slow down and maybe savor the time that we have?
I hope that's true, yeah. I know that one crucial thing that one psychologist told me as we get into the colder months is to have to know that your social contact is going to be less frequent and it's going to be more difficult in person, but that really can let you savor the time that you do have with somebody just to talk or catch up, to have a deep conversation. I know that just recently, I had this kind of hours-long coffee walk, distant and masked, with a good friend of mine around the National Mall. And that interaction alone kept me afloat for, you know, probably 2 weeks longer than it would have before the pandemic. I found that these kinds of things I could really appreciate. They might feel smaller, and they are smaller. But they give us something to look forward to, and I think we can find what's really meaningful in them in this time.
Stephen Johnson is an audience editor for The Washington Post and the creator of the What Day Is It newsletter. Stephen, thanks so much for spending some of your time with me.
It was my pleasure. Thanks.
Well, time is so fleeting, so that's the end of our show. Thanks, as always, for tuning in. And, of course, you can continue to call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.